judge and judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, all persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. As part of Project Outreach, we are hearing oral argument today at UC Hastings College of the Law. The court calls the case of United States v. Airman Cameron A. Owens, number ACM 39457. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the military judge erred by denying the defense motion to suppress appellant's statement made to Italian police officers known as the Carabinieri. Appellate counsel, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant wishes to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes. Thank you, counsel. You may proceed.
Chief Judge Mayberry, members of the court, and may it please the court, my name is Major Mark Schwartz, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Burnett, we represent the appellant, Airman First Class Cameron Owens, in this case. I still felt like I had to make a statement, because I agreed to make a statement before the lawyer, sir. I did not feel like I had a choice anymore. This is what the appellant told the senior trial counsel on cross-examination during his testimony during the motion to suppress hearing. The appellant's repeated requests to remain silent and have an attorney were denied every time. The appellant was told the only way he would be given an attorney was if he gave a statement. The appellant was being deprived of food and water for a period of several hours. OSI relied on the appellant's statement and therefrom the illegally seized evidence to secure their search authorizations in their investigation of the appellant. At the time of this questioning, the appellant was only 18 years old. OSI used the Carabinieri, a foreign police agency, as an instrumentality of the Air Force, and as a result, avoided the requirements of Article 31B, MRE 305, and MRE 311. The military judge erred in denying the motion to suppress the appellant's statements made to the Carabinieri and all derivative evidence derived therefrom because of these violations. Now, as I say to the appellant that this time was 18 years old, he had never lived outside the United States until he was assigned to Aviano Air Base in Italy. He had never been in police custody before in his life. He had been deprived of sleep, food, and water during his questioning at the Carabinieri police station. He had consumed alcohol the night before, and it was one of the first times in his life he'd ever consumed alcohol or gotten drunk.
Major Schwartz, hadn't he worked an entire duty day and then gone and worked out before he was actually arrested?
He had worked a duty day and had worked out at the time he was apprehended on base, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And counsel, when you say he was deprived, is there evidence on the record that he ever asked for food and water and was denied?
While he didn't specifically ask for food and water, Your Honor, the deprivation of food and water is a factor when you're looking at the totality of the circumstances of the self-determination being overborne or the voluntariness of one's statement. And the factors come from Brisbane, which was cited in the military judge's analysis in Article Appellate Exhibit 30, excuse me. And the additional factors would be the lack of age of that accused. Airman Owens was 18. Education, he only had a high school diploma, and he had no prior law enforcement training or dealings with law enforcement. The intelligence of the accused, his ASVABs were certainly average, Your Honors. Lack of being advised of his constitutional rights, it's very clear at no time was he advised of his constitutional rights. The length of detention and repeated and prolonged questioning, he was questioned for several hours, repeatedly questioned despite his exercising his right to remain silent, requesting an attorney. And finally, Your Honor, as I just mentioned, the punishment that the accused did go through, such as deprivation of food and water, which he was certainly deprived of. Now, regarding the investigation, OSI was actively participating. OSI and SFOI first reviewed the dorm surveillance video recordings, identifying the appellant. The carabiner didn't have their own surveillance systems. This was on an airbase, but they certainly assisted the carabiner with this, identified the appellant. And after the positive identification, the appellant was apprehended and handed over to the carabiner. The appellant was never read his Article 31 rights, and OSI stood idly by at all times that the appellant was in carabiner custody. In fact, the appellant was also not told of any of his rights he would have had under the Italian laws. The appellant was taken to his dorm room for a search. At that time, the carabiner and OSI had sought a search authorization to go into his dorm room, and the appellant did not consent to this search. OSI even assisted the carabiner investigate the room. They brought the crime scene investigation kit. They brought the footies and the gloves for the agents to use. And they even brought the blacklight fluorescing equipment and actually fluoresced items within the dorm room while this warrantless search was going on. OSI also expanded the boundaries of the crime scene. Looking at the perimeter of the courtyard, they actually expanded the search area to larger than what originally was because they saw an article of clothing in that courtyard. And when Airman Owens finally did give that statement, the SFOI interpreter translated the statement, but also participated in the questioning of Airman Owens by talking with the carabiner on what questions to ask the appellant and joining in on letting Airman Owens know that his questions didn't make sense or they weren't good enough.
In Schwartz, can you just repeat that? Did you say an OSI agent participated?
SFOI, Your Honor. I apologize if I said the wrong acronym.
You may not have.
It was a security forces translator, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And during the entire investigation, only witness statements the carabiner collected were from active duty airmen, which the OSI used all of this information. Now, while the appellant was it in the hands of the carabiner, he did repeatedly ask for a lawyer. He was driven to his dorm room while he continued to be questioned on where the weapon was, why he did it, questions to that effect while Airman Owens continued to ask for an attorney. In fact, the questioning and yelling was so loud towards Airman Owens, A1CJS, who was also being questioned at the carabiner station at that same time, testified he could hear the carabiner yelling at Airman Owens, asking him why he did it. Airman Owens was finally given an attorney, but he had to make a promise first. He was told the only way he would get an attorney, an Italian attorney, would be if he agreed to make a statement. And this lawyer wasn't provided for quite a few hours. And there had been attempts to question him many times before this attorney came to the carabiner station. By the time the Italian attorney showed up, Mr. L.R., the appellant had been awake for the most part of a period almost 40 hours, looking at the day before and the current day. Hadn't eaten anything since he had oatmeal for breakfast early that morning. Now, Mr. L.R., the Italian attorney who did show up at the Carabinieri police station, testified he was in a hurry to be elsewhere when he showed up to the police station. He had tickets to go to see the local team play Barcelona in a soccer match. Mr. L.R. walked into the station and only spoke to the carabiner for a few minutes. They told him the appellant was guilty because they had him on video. Mr. L.R. did not ask for clarification, did not ask to review any evidence, nor did he actually look at any evidence before agreeing to talk to the appellant. Mr. L.R. spoke to the appellant in an open area with an earshot of others. He simply told the appellant exactly what the carabiner had been telling him. He thought he'd be guilty and they had evidence to prove that, though he hadn't reviewed any evidence. Mr. Elmore knew the jurisdiction would go to the Air Force, still claimed that this was in appellant's best interest without looking at any evidence to confess immediately.
So, counsel, you haven't raised ineffective assistance of counsel as an issue before the court, have you?
No, Your Honor.
So, can you explain how the Italian attorney's performance plays into the analysis here?
Your Honor, again, looking at the totality of circumstances, and I turn to United States versus French, which talks about, in French, there's a patent that they talk about, and I'll just get right to it. It's important that United States representatives be present to protect U.S. service members' rights being investigated by foreign officials. A serviceman who is under investigation by a foreign police is present in that country because of military orders. Having sent him there, the United States labors under a duty to protect him with respect to the criminal procedures of that foreign government. Since pretrial investigation is as important as the trial in fixing guilt or innocence, it is also desirable that United States agents be present during investigation by foreign police into an offense of which a United States serviceman is suspected. And my point to this is, Your Honor, that by the mere accident of Airman Owens being assigned, or just happenstance of Airman Owens being assigned at Aviano, he didn't have the same process an airman being stationed in Conus would have had. And though not raising effective assistance of counsel, it is a factor looking at the totality of circumstances if Airman Owens did have his due process rights violated. And certainly, Mr. LR did him no favors. He was distracted in a hurry, wanted to be elsewhere, and had a duty towards Airman Owens. And this treatment certainly would have been different elsewhere. So another factor in the totality of circumstances for sure, Your Honor.
But the ultimate question, or one of the pertinent questions, I guess, really is, was the statement voluntary? Is that what you're getting at?
Correct, Your Honor. So, appellant's first position is that based on OSS participation, obviously, MRE-305-F2 would mean that he was entitled to having his rights read based on OSS participation. But notwithstanding that, looking at the self-determination or voluntariness of his statement, the military judge did err in his analysis of whether or not Airman Owens gave his statement voluntarily, which he did not. And Airman Owens testified that his will was overborne. And even if you look a couple days later, as he's in the OSS interrogation room talking to Master Sergeant DT, he's hysterical with everything he's been through. His will continued to be overborne throughout the whole process, Your Honor.
Well, he consistently asked for an attorney when he was talking to the Carabinieri, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And ultimately, he was provided with an attorney.
Correct, Your Honor.
And it was after that point and after he got the attorney's advice that he made a statement. Correct.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, doesn't the fact that he waited until to make a statement until he received the thing that he had been asking for, in other words, an attorney to advise him, doesn't that suggest that he kind of stood up for his rights and his will wasn't ever born?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree for the reason being that Airman Owens stated that his understanding was he made a deal with the Carabinieri, that the only reason he received that attorney was that he had to make a statement. And when the senior trial counsel on cross-examination really grilled him about this issue and asked the substantially similar question, Your Honor, these were Airman Owens' answers. He had never dealt with law enforcement before, and he felt that he was on the hook to give a statement. And that's exactly what Airman Owens did.
Mr. Schwartz, didn't Airman Owens ultimately say that he agreed to make a statement because not only had he initially agreed to, but because the lawyer told him it would be in his best interest to do so?
Your Honor, yes and no. So he did agree to make a statement because he said he had given his word that he was going to give a statement. But when Airman Owens was questioned about whether or not Mr. LR had his best interest at hand, Airman Owens testified he didn't know.
Right, but his lawyer did advise him that it was the lawyer's advice that it would be in his best interest to make a statement, right?
Yes, Your Honor. He said that this is what the lawyer was telling me, but I did not know if Mr. Eller had my best interest in mind.
So why did Mr. Eller not have his best interest in mind, or what would you point to in the record that would be deficient about Mr. Eller's performance?
The fact that he didn't request a confidential room to speak with Airman Owens would be the first. The second would be that he did not request to review any evidence or video surveillance. And third would be him admitting that he was in a hurry to be elsewhere. So obviously not paying full attention to his duty at hand, Your Honor.
Would it matter that he did not ask Airman Owens exactly what Airman Owens was going to tell the carabiner?
Yes, Your Honor. That's also important. It was a very brief conversation as well.
Counsel, before you move on, I just want to loop back to when you were quoting from the French case in terms of the duty to protect an airman who finds himself involved in a foreign country's system. Was I misunderstanding you when you said that that was Mr. LR's responsibility to protect him, or that there's another entity, someone from the Air Force, whose obligation to protect him while he was going through the process down at the Aviano City Station, having been removed from the base?
Your Honor, ultimately it does fall on the government and OSI. However, I was lumping in Mr. LR to the process and the totality of the circumstances of what Airman Owens did go through, being under investigation in a foreign country. So it's ultimately OSI's responsibility. And right from the get-go, again, based on their participation in the investigation under MRA 305, this became a military investigation. Airman Owens was entitled to all the rights associated with a military investigation at that point, that attached.
Okay, but then based on some of the questions from my fellow judges, you also very adamantly assert that Mr. LR had an independent duty as counsel provided to Airman Owens to provide certain services, as opposed to protecting him as a member of the military had an obligation to protect another airman, but Mr. LR had a different kind of duty in his capacity as representing Airman Owens.
Certainly, Your Honor, and at the point that this became a military investigation, Airman Owens was entitled to counsel, civilian or military, but to the level that is expected and that Airman Owens would have received. Oconus or Oconus, based on a military investigation, and he would have gotten from an air defense counsel or something substantially similar.
So, counsel, staying with the idea that this was that there was Air Force participation in this Italian investigation, would you agree that under the SOFA, the United States was required to provide some degree of support to the Italians in their investigation?
Correct, Your Honor. And under the SOFA, clearly there's concurrent jurisdiction when an investigation begins. But based on the SOFA Section 7, Paragraph 3, Alpha, Indigo, the United States Air Force does qualify for primary jurisdiction based on there being a victim and alleged perpetrator who were active duty airmen or military servicemen at that point. So at that point, it's a foregone conclusion that this is going to be a military case.
But there is a process for that, isn't there?
There is, Your Honor.
And that provision doesn't preclude either the Italians or the United States from conducting an investigation. It's just a question of to what degree was there a merger, or did the United States participate or inveigle the Italians to do the investigating for them. Would you agree with that?
Correct, Your Honor. And for instance, in French, similarly to this case, the military law enforcement agency assisted in handing over the accused to foreign law enforcement. But what the military law enforcement did not do in French, which OSI did do in Airman Owens' case, is entered the dorm room pursuant to a warrantless search and assisted in finding evidence using blacklight fluorescing items to secure evidence, knowing that this was a warrantless search going into Aaron Owens' backpack. These are steps that went beyond the French case, Your Honor. So,
thank you.
Now, regarding the statement to the carabinieri, Aaron Owens testified he was very scared at the carabinieri station. Again, he felt like he had to make a statement because that's the only way he would get the attorney. And the SFOI, Security Forces Office translator, was also assisting the carabinieri in crafting questions and raising their voice and yelling at Aaron Owens. Aaron Owens was still being pressured while giving a statement that his answers weren't making sense or he needed to change his answers. Aaron Owens, after giving the statement, was given the statement written in Italian. It was translated, but he was not given a copy written in English so he could read it before signing the statement. And he was also told he was still stuck in that interrogation room until he signed that statement written in Italian.
So what's the significance of the fact that he didn't get a copy of it in English if you agree that it was translated for him and that his attorney, for example, signed it and that it was accurate and so forth? What's the significance of the fact that he didn't actually get an English translation in writing if it was nevertheless orally translated for him?
Well, not legally significant as far as a bullet point in one of our analysis today. It is another example or another thing to show about how Aaron Owens was treated differently. This case was treated differently than a service member who would have been under investigation at a CONUS installation. Now, after Aaron Owens does sign the statement that's written in Italian, he is thrown into an Italian jail with foreign nationals there. During that time, he also testified he was scared, and there were fights breaking out in the jail cell he was housed in for those 2 days. 2 days later, OSI did pick up Aaron Owens, and he was taken immediately to OSI and put into an interrogation room. His first sergeant came into the room with him, and Aaron Owens was distraught, was crying. And all this time, OSI was recording this discussion. Aaron Owens' distraught demeanor, his excessive crying, everything that we see on video in the recording when he's talked to his first session just shows how much he'd been through and how traumatic it was on Aaron Owens throughout this process.
So, counsel, let's assume for, and I don't want to jump ahead too much, but assume for purposes of argument that there was a problem with the interrogation. Can you talk a little bit about inevitable discovery and what position the Air Force authorities would have been in at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. So, regarding inevitable discovery, our position is that there wouldn't have been probable cause to search the appellant's room, and this is why. The victim couldn't identify the appellant. If you look at page 14 of her 18 April 2017 OSI interview, she says, I quote, I never saw his face. And you can find that transcribed interview in the Article 32 report. That's the first time I found it in the right yard. The victim also said she did not know where the suspect was running to. So surveillance did show Aaron Owens walking around the dorm rooms. He walked around about 20 different rooms. Fingerprints were checked for all around the victim's dorm room, the entry doors, the exit doors, etc. We now know that there were no fingerprints linked to Aaron Owens at the victim's main door, her patio door, or her individual room door. There were no prints taken on the knife block itself where they believe the knife was taken from. And there was no DNA or blood of the appellants found in the victim's room. So the reason there wouldn't be inevitable discovery, Your Honor, is while we have Aaron Owens on surveillance walking around the dorms, we have no evidence that links him to the victim's drummer. So certainly, based on Aaron Owens being on video surveillance, certainly he's brought in for questioning. But if we look at how he reacted at the Carabiner station, he would have exercised his Article 31 rights. And even if they had processed him in CODIS, taken fingerprints and whatnot, they still wouldn't have linked him to the victim's room.
So basically, without the statement to the Carabiner, there wouldn't have been probable cause to obtain a search warrant. There was search authorization, I'm sorry.
And if you look at OSI's heavy reliance on Aaron Owens' statement, if you parse out those things, you're left with no PC at that point.
And another question I wanted to ask, and again, not to skip ahead too much, but if assuming that there was an error, what exactly was the impact on the trial or the harm from this particular error? Because they didn't use the statement. The prosecution didn't actually use the statement at his trial. They didn't introduce the knife. And then obviously there was some DNA evidence. So could you speak to that?
Yeah, the harm is the derivative evidence. Aaron Owens' statement wasn't used, but all the derivative evidence was. And this would have been a case where the government's strength of their case would not have been as strong. And ultimately, hinging on the other issue, though not here today and in front of your honors, but another ultimate issue on appeal is whether or not there was an intent to kill that was ever found. So there's significant prejudice involved here based on the derivative evidence being brought into Aaron Owens.
And so specifically, how would the prosecution's case have been weaker, substantially weaker, if they didn't have the actual knife that was used?
Without the jacket, the jeans, and the knife, Your Honor, they're trying to make an argument beyond a reasonable doubt that based on Aaron Owens acting peculiar around dorm rooms, that would be proving beyond a reasonable doubt that he harmed the victim in some way. And you have a victim that could not identify him either.
Well, you mentioned the jacket and the jeans, but those weren't derived from the statement, were they?
No, Your Honor. Those were derivative of the violation of MRE 305 F2 based on OSS participation in a warrantless search. Five of the status forces agreement as well. It states that the agency that is getting primary jurisdiction will get help from the other law enforcement agency in putting them in their custody. This wasn't what Airman Owens' experience was in the process that OSI used. They handed Airman Owens over to the Carabinieri, participated in searches that would have violated Article 31, MRA 305, and MRA 311, and reap the benefits. If you look at the period up to the point where they write their search authorizations and send them up to see if there's PC, there's no evidence that OSI was actively pursuing a search warrant at that time. The alleged incident occurred on the 11th of April. And pending further questions, Your Honors, I see them. Chief Judge, I see them out of time.
Please, go ahead and finish your thought.
OSI, again, just to repeat, reaped the benefits of the way this was handled, which was in violation of the SAS Force Agreement, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Government Counsel, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Mayberry, Senior Judge Johnson, and Judge Lewis, may it please the court. I'm Captain Peter Kellett, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Julie Pitvorek. We represent the United States in this proceeding. This court should find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding that the evidence derived from appellant's statements were admissible. And just to be clear, the focus of the issue, meaning what derivative evidence we're talking about here today, is the knife and DNA evidence. That's what the issue is on appeal. Appellate counsel referred to the warrantless search. To the extent that this court finds that it has been sufficiently raised through the assignment of error. I just want to address that briefly. That's governed by Military Rule of Evidence 311. And under 311, the only time that warrantless searches are inadmissible, but warrantless searches conducted by foreign authorities are inadmissible, are when the appellant is subjected to gross and brutal maltreatment. The record is devoid of any evidence that appellant was subjected to any gross or brutal maltreatment during the search of his room when his jacket and jeans were found. So what we're really talking about here is the knife and DNA evidence under MRE 305F2.
Yeah, but doesn't the OSI's activity during the search of the room impact whether they participated in the investigation that the Carbonari were performing?
Sure, and obviously, yes, Your Honor, that would impact 305F2 as well, in addition to 311, but my first point was that the 311 assignment of error wasn't sufficiently raised on appeal, but to the extent it isn't, I wanted to address the gross and brutal maltreatment prong of 311, and also through my argument of 305, I also address why it wasn't participated in by the United States military, Your Honor. And turning to the knife and DNA evidence, under 305F2, they're both admissible as derivative evidence of appellant's statement because the Carabinieri's interrogation was not conducted, instigated, or participated in by military personnel or their agents. And the statement was given voluntarily. Now, under the first part of that test, the United States did not participate in the interrogation of appellant. First of all, there were no military personnel present. Appellant even admitted this when he testified during the pretrial motions hearing. So what we're really concerned about in terms of who was present at that interrogation is the SFOI interpreter. I'd first like to point to this court's attention that 305F2 specifically allows for an interpreter to be present. But even in this case, Mr. Jeezy, the interpreter, was not a law enforcement officer or detective acting on the part of the government or the behest of the government. He was there strictly to translate the Italian that was being given to defend him by the Carabinieri that were there. Appellant testified, this is on page 320 of the record, appellant testified that the follow-up questions or statements that his story didn't make sense seemed to come from the Carabinieri and then translated by Mr. GZ. So I would ask this court find that Mr. GZ was not the one that was actually interrogating appellant during the interrogation.
Would you agree that the military judge's factual finding was a little ambiguous in this regard?
Yes, Your Honor. To be frank, Your Honor, CAF, Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, has been a little unclear about whether or not this is a de novo standard or clearly erroneous standard. Under either standard, I think the record is clear, though, that Mr. GZ, the interpreter, was not the one that was questioning the appellant, and specifically looking at appellant's own statement on page 320 of the record.
Would you agree, hypothetically, if the interpreter had asked a question, a substantive question without filtering it through or it coming from the Carabinieri, that would go beyond what's contemplated with mere translation? That would be participation?
Depending on what the question is, yes, Your Honor. But I also want to just make clear that there's no evidence that Mr. GZ was acting on behalf of the United States military during this meeting. He said he regularly interprets and translates interrogations for the Carabinieri, and that's what his job was there today. There's no evidence that he was acting at the behest of AFOSI or security forces that night to get a graded confession or anything like that to skirt the requirements of 305F2. Therefore, the interrogation, based on those factors, the interrogation was not participated in by the United States. And at the same time, the United States did not conduct or instigate the interrogation either. They did not ask the Italians to interrogate appellant. They didn't assist them in the interrogation of the appellant, did not give them a list of questions or things that they wanted to know through the interrogation.
Counsel, the facts do say that the United States turned appellant over to the Carabinieri while they were on the installation, and he was apprehended by military forces, and then they gave appellant to the Carabinieri.
That's correct, Your Honor. But at this time, concurrent jurisdiction existed. So the Caribbean and the United States Air Force had jurisdiction over the case. And per the SOFA, the United States or the Caribbean, depending on who's taking lead on the investigation, is required to assist in the apprehension of individuals and turning them over, identifying a perpetrator. And that's what happened in this case during this period where there was concurrent jurisdiction. And to the extent that this court might question or consider whether or not the Air Force was sitting on its laurels or not requesting jurisdiction as expediently as it should have, I would want to point to the court's attention the fact that Special Agent JW testified that they initially attempted to cordon the area, stabilize the crime scene, and begin investigating, OSI that is, and when the Italians showed up and they were not being allowed to investigate, to be the primary investigative agency, they threatened the special agent with arrest for obstruction of justice, meaning let us in here or we're going to arrest you. Any reasonable military law enforcement officer at that moment would obviously hold back, or pull back, excuse me, and allow the Italians to take over. And that's exactly what Special Agent JW did. Surely the law does not require that Special Agent JW fight with the Carabinieri or take any sort of aggressive action at that point. So,
I think we all have a question. Go ahead.
If that was the result, right up front, that they're threatening the OSI agent with obstruction of justice, does that not mean that OSI has a duty to make sure that if they turn appellant over to the Carabinieri, that his rights are going to be protected under the Status of Forces Agreement? As a military member, if they're threatening the agent with that, what are they going to do to appellant?
Well, I mean, I think the only thing that could be derived is not that they're going to mistreat appellant, and also if there is a duty to protect appellant, it's not a duty to protect appellant's United States constitutional rights. The American Constitution would not apply if the lead investigative agency are the Italians, and surely OSI does not have they don't have the training, experience, and knowledge to protect all of appellant's constitutional rights. In Italy, when the Italians took over.
Counsel, before you end that issue, the lead investigation determination appeared to be made by both parties in this case. AFOSI and security forces believed they were running an investigation until the Carabinieri came down and threatened them with continuing to do so. Nevertheless, throughout that day and the following days, United States government law enforcement continued to run an investigation in this case, correct?
That's correct, yes, Your Honor.
So, what did they stop doing when they were threatened by the particular Carabinieri agent in this case?
Well, obviously, the biggest, or the most glaring and obvious thing that they could not do is have access to the appellant, because they, pursuant to the SOFA, the Status Forces Agreement, they turned appellant over to the Carabinieri. So they couldn't question appellant, but they did conduct the independent investigation that you alluded to, Your Honor. They searched the grounds, they looked for the knife, they scoured the surveillance video, they took the surveillance video, sent it out to the units to identify appellant, all while they were waiting on this jurisdiction decision. Because per policy and procedure of OSI, they were to conduct an independent investigation regardless. And obviously OSI is not the one that requests jurisdiction, it's the base, through the base legal office. And as was talked about a little briefly on during appellate counsel's argument, that's a process that goes through several layers. The base legal office has to request that. It goes up to higher headquarters. And even if higher headquarters approves it, it goes to the Navy in Naples. And only after the Navy has reviewed and approved that request does it eventually reach the Italians.
So in this case, it was the Italians who contacted the Air Force.
That's right, Your Honor.
Based on an American forces crime against another member of the forces on the military installation. And so they knew under the SOFA that this was a primary right of refusal case for the government, the United States government.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. LR knew within 10 minutes of arriving at the police station that this was a primary United States case. But because it's a laborious process, the U.S. government didn't fail to request jurisdiction in a timely fashion?
Well, I would say two things to that, Your Honor. The base, no one on the base has the authority to assert jurisdiction. The Italians recognized this, as Your Honor pointed out, and said, hey, this looks like it's going to be yours. The prosecutor contacted the base and said, if you just give me something in writing saying you're going to assert jurisdiction, we'll go ahead and give it to you. And that's exactly what happened. The base did not have the authority to do that preliminarily. They have to get an approval from Naples, and then, and only then, can the United States military formally request jurisdiction.
Right, but is there anything in the record that says prior to the phone call from the Italians to the base that the base had started that process, the victim and the appellant were both military members?
There's nothing in the record in terms of a document showing that there's a dated memo and that's going up, but I would refer, Your Honor, to Dr. I believe it's SP's testimony saying that that was in progress. We don't know how far the process that was, but just that she testified that they were making efforts to assert jurisdiction. But the record is silent in terms of how far along they were in that process during this 48-hour period.
So, counsel, as I look at French, it seems to me the court went through sort of a two-step process. First, they looked at the investigation overall to see if this was one where it was merged or there was participation by both nations. And then when they found that it was strictly a British investigation, then they looked at the actual interrogation. So would you agree that, so it seems to me that looking at the interrogation and the actual investigation or participation in that is a relevant question, but it's also relevant to look at the overarching investigation that led up to that point, kind of as we've been alluding to. In that regard, do you have any precedent for the idea that examining the suspect's clothing for the presence of blood with a black light would not be participation in the investigation?
So I don't have anything that specific, Your Honor, but I would point to the facts of French. And in French, the United States military met frequently with the foreign British police in that instance to share information, coordinate activities. They assisted in apprehending the appellant in that case. A military member actually sat in on the interrogation and even urged the appellant not to lie during that interrogation. Afterwards, they provided the British with a military working dog and a handler to actually search the appellant's room, which is probably the most analogous fact to the blacklight situation that occurred here. And even then, the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces found that the actions taken did not constitute a joint investigation. I would submit to this court that in the facts of United States versus Owens, the activities fell well short of the amount of participation that occurred in French. Therefore, this court should find that the U.S. military did not participate in the investigation or interrogation of the appellant in this case. Next, the next part of the 305 Foxtrot 2 analysis is whether or not the appellant's statement was given voluntarily. And I know that was discussed in great detail during appellant's argument, but I wanted to point out just a few facts that demonstrates that the appellant did make his own decision to provide a statement. First, there was no instance where law enforcement placed him in fear. Appellant even testified during the pretrial motions hearing that no one yelled at him. There was no evidence that anyone used a threat of force or violence against him to coerce him into making a statement. And appellant repeatedly stated that he did not want to answer any questions and that he wanted an attorney. And understanding the Fifth Amendment jurisprudence, we have to immediately stop questioning. But again, I would just want to make clear that Fifth Amendment protections do not apply to foreign law enforcement investigations. And he also agreed, as I believe as Judge Lewis had pointed out, that he was not forced to make a statement, and he only decided to make a statement after speaking with his attorney, Mr. L.R. I also want to point out page 67 of Appellate Exhibit 5, and that is basically a translated summary and account of the interview of appellant. And on that page, There's a part that shows that appellant was again informed after meeting with Mr. L.R. He was again informed that under Italian law specifically, his statements can always be used against him and that he has the right to remain silent. And then after that, appellant, according to the summary, appellant stated that he still wished to provide a statement. So even after meeting with his attorney, he was again reminded by the Italians, by the Cabinieri, that he had the right to remain silent. He still agreed to provide a statement at that point.
So, counsel, you mentioned the meeting with the attorney. Hypothetically speaking, if we had concerns about the attorney's performance in this case, how, if at all, does that play into our analysis?
Well, unfortunately, there's not a lot of case law on 305F2 voluntariness. How to determine that. So a lot of the case law, it seems to be drawn from Fifth Amendment jurisprudence to determine voluntariness. And under Fifth Amendment jurisprudence, I would say that Mr. L.R. was not acting as an instrumentality of the government. So to the extent this court finds that he was ineffective, he was not an agent of the government, he was a civilian. Therefore, the United States military did not create the situation that overbore his will in that instance.
So the record and the judge's findings suggest sort of a quid pro quo where after he kept insisting on getting an attorney, the Carabinieri agreed that if he agreed to make a statement, they would provide an attorney, and that's what happened. So there was sort of an agreement, if you will. But is it fair to read an implication into that he was asking for a competent attorney or an attorney who would perform according to professional standards? Or is it simply enough that somebody who presented themselves as an attorney and advised him to confess had that conversation?
I think it's the former. But under Italian law, that may be the best thing to do in that situation when he was advising the appellant. And I would point this court's attention to United States versus Pinson as far as that goes. And in that case, the appellant was being interrogated by Icelandic authorities. He was provided with an Icelandic attorney after requesting counsel. And there, the attorney advised him that under Icelandic law, it could be viewed negatively if you exercise your right to remain silent. Therefore, it may be in your best interest to provide a statement. There, the appellant decided to provide a statement, and CAF upheld the military judge's ruling that the statement was not involuntary in that instance. So even if that plays into this court's analysis, I would point this court's attention to Pinson to show that that is not a dispositive fact in the voluntariness analysis.
Counsel, before you leave that point, how do you believe the fact that Mr. L.R. knew that this would be a U.S. case, informed his client that this would be a U.S. case, and essentially that night at the Aviano City Police Station said, our dealings are 99% done today because this is not going to be in the Italian system. So do you think that factual distinction makes Pinson less applicable at all? Where there the advice is given based on the Icelandic law, which would theoretically rule or dictate how that case processed. Whereas here we have the attorney himself saying this isn't an Italian case.
Well, I would say two things to that, Your Honor. First, if he's telling that to appellant, so appellant obviously heard and knew that the Italians are not going to be handling this case. Therefore, why does he need to talk to the Italian law enforcement anymore at that point? Would be a reasonable inference that could be made there. Obviously, if he knew it was going to the U.S. authorities, then he could continue to assert his Fifth Amendment right or Article 31 rights or continue to say, I want counsel. The second thing I would say, Your Honor, is that even after being provided that advice, that it may be in his best interest to speak, he was again reminded by the Carabinieri that he had the right to remain silent under Italian law, and he still decided to waive those rights and speak.
Is the evidence for that that you look to, is that simply from the translated version of his statement as it was recorded, or is there evidence that somebody actually re-advised him of his rights at that point? And what I'm getting at, is it possible that the Italians, when they drafted the statement, they simply were looking to the fact that he'd already said that he would make a statement, and therefore that he was agreeing to make a statement and recorded it that way.
So, Your Honor, I would say yes, there is something in the record that supports that. The interpreter who was present during the interrogation actually testified about that actual line on the document, and that's on page 266 of the record as well. So there was an independent, someone that's, a document that's not from the Carabinieri to also confirm that fact, Your Honor. Therefore, considering the totality of circumstances, appellant's confession was given voluntarily under MRE 3052. Therefore, the judge did not abuse his discretion in ruling that the derivative evidence was admissible under Military Rule of Evidence 304. However, should this court find that the military judge erred in those findings, the evidence still would have been inevitably discovered by AFOSI. And what I'm pointing to at this point, the standard at this point, is 304 Bravo 3. And the standard written in 304 is that the evidence had to have been obtained even if the statement wasn't made. And the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces expanded on that test in United States versus Hoffman. And they basically require that AFOSI, in this case, must have possessed or were actively pursuing evidence and leads that would have inevitably led to the discovery of evidence in a lawful manner. Here, they both possessed and were actively pursuing the evidence that would have inevitably been discovered even without the appellant's statement. They had Airman A.S.'s statement, where she described the attack, matched with the dorm's surveillance footage that showed appellant sneaking into her room and then hurriedly exiting her room. And shortly afterwards, she is running from her room, clutching her neck, and going to a neighbor to call EMTs. And also the fact that appellant's first sergeant, upon seeing the surveillance footage, identified him. These things show that the evidence of the crime, it found in the knife specifically, would have been inevitably discovered. And at the same time, the active pursuit, I kind of mentioned the surveillance footage and what else I was doing with the surveillance footage. Those are all things that point to the fact that, or the conclusion, that the U.S. military was actively pursuing this evidence as well. In addition to the surveillance footage analysis that was being conducted, OSI conducted outbound checks looking for the perpetrator of the crime. They were independently searching the dormitory grounds for a knife, and based on his comings and goings in the video, they saw he went to a laundry room and also to his room. They searched the laundry room for the knife. So the record showed and supports a conclusion that this would have been inevitably discovered because it was within the possession and control of the United States military, and they were also actively pursuing the knife or the instrumentality of the crime. And then I'm leaving the question whether or not the evidence would have been unlawfully seized in this case under Hoffman, because as demonstrated by the record, OSI applied for three separate search authorizations with the magistrate in order to, based on probable cause, in order to search for the knife, to seize his DNA evidence, and also seize his cellular phone. In addition to that, I would also like to address, I don't believe this was mentioned on argument, but actually it may have, the fact that because the Italians couldn't find the knife, that it made it not inevitable that the U.S. military would have found the knife when they searched the appellant's dorm room. The first thing that I would like to point out is that the Italians were not in possession of the same facts that the U.S. military was in possession of when the U.S. military conducted the search of the room. At that point in time, the Italians hadn't searched the laundry room and hadn't searched the grounds of the dormitory. So the U.S. military had, and knowing there's only one more place that the appellant had been, his dorm room, it is a reasonable inference for this court to make that OSI would have focused their search on the dorm room, given that they had not found the knife in the other areas that appellant was found to be on the video. Therefore, this court should find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding that the search or the evidence would have been inevitably discovered and admissible under that as well. But even if this court finds that the military judge erred on any of those provisions, including interval discovery, appellant did not suffer prejudice, and any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Basically, even without the knife and DNA evidence, which is the subject of this issue, there was plenty of evidence to prove appellant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Aaron A.S. identified the appellant in court. A.S. described the crime, where he repeatedly and wildly stabbed her in the head, neck, shoulder, and arms, which went to the intent element of the attempted murder specification. The surveillance footage corroborated her story. Like I said, it showed him going in and out of her room and then running back to his room and then later to the laundry room. Also, the dorm footage, and this has not been a great topic under this issue, but the dorm footage also, coupled with the testimony of dorm residents, proves the unlawful entry specifications as well, beyond a reasonable doubt. Going back to the attempted murder, the pictures of A.S.'s injuries that were presented at trial showed the severity of her injuries, showed and also corroborated the wild, repeated stabs that appellant made on A.S. These were not surgical, they weren't surgical in the sense that appellant tried to strike only non-lethal blows. When considering that A.S. testified, he wildly and repeatedly stabbed her with a sharp object. And finally, the forensic pathologist's testimony corroborated her testimony. His description showed that her injuries were sharp, forced injuries consistent with a knife attack. He described how easily one of Airman A.S.'s carotid arteries could have been opened due to the attack and caused rapid death, and also confirmed that the force used to cause the injuries she sustained in the attack could have easily been enough to pierce one of her vital arteries and result in death, all of which goes to the intent element of attempted murder. In short, there was more than sufficient evidence presented to show appellant guilty of both all crimes that he was charged, attempted murder and unlawful entry. If there are no...
Kevin Kellett, yes, so wasn't the knife handle broken during stabbing?
I'm not sure if there was any evidence to show that it would happen during the stabbing, but yes, they did find a knife handle outside on the ground, and the blade was found independent of that.
Didn't an expert testify that that broken piece was actually from the knife that was found in the orange shoebox in Pine's room?
Yes, Your Honor.
So wouldn't we have to disregard that testimony as well?
Yes, Your Honor. And even without the knife handle evidence, Airman A.S.'s testimony, the forensic pathologist's testimony establishing intent and the severity of injuries and how it easily could have resulted in death, with the surveillance footage shows that appellant committed attempted murder that evening, even without the knife handle or the DNA evidence or the actual knife blade that was found in the room.
So, counsel, I wanted to ask you about sort of the relationship between with the derivative evidence, material of evidence 304 and bill of evidence 311. In your brief, you say that the applicable rule is 304 for basically evidence derived from a statement and not 311, evidence derived from a search. But in his ruling, the military judge only referred to 311 with regard to the derivative evidence from the statement. So do you think only one is applicable or both applicable, or did the military judge fail to use the proper rule in his analysis?
Your Honor, it's my understanding that 304 would be the applicable rule since we're talking about statements, where 311 talks about unlawful searches and warrantless searches. Given that the subject here is the DNA evidence and the knife, which were derived from the statement, 305F2 and 304 would be the applicable rules. But even if this court finds otherwise and affords the military judge no deference on a de novo review after considering the facts of the record and that AFOSI, I see my time has elapsed, man.
Please go ahead and continue.
Considering what OSI possessed and were actively pursuing in terms of their investigation, what they were doing, it still would have been inevitably discovered under United States versus Hoffman. conclusion, the evidence derived from the appellant's statement was admissible under MRA 305F2, and even if not, it would have been inevitably discovered. And should this court disagree and find the error, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Accordingly, the United States respectfully requests this court deny the appellant's claim and affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant's counsel, you may proceed.
Your Honor, I wanted to reiterate under MRA 305, specifically this being an investigation that was participated in by OSI. Appellant's counsel just talked about the Carabinieri threatening OSI agents. And though on its face, if you look at part of the testimony, there were threats. If you look at the rest of the testimony of Agent J.W., and this is between pages of 60 and 65 of the record, the Carabinieri threatened OSI with obstruction, but it was more posturing because OSI Agent J.W. pushed back and said, no, wait, don't go into Airman Owens' dorm room until we can bring the crime scene investigation equipment, the gloves, the booties, the light to fluoresce. And to show that this was a joint investigation right there, the Carabinieri stood down and they waited for OSI to arrive at the scene with this equipment that OSI walked into the room during a warrantless search and actually used with the Carabinieri at this time, which goes further than in French law enforcement just dropping off a dog. That this is a step much further in the participation aspect. Now, Kelly also mentioned the gross mistreatment that just didn't get there for Airman Owens. Again, looking at the factors under Brisbane, it goes to show that this was gross mistreatment. This was not a voluntary statement. And Airman Owens' will was overborne at that point. Kelly talks about the identification of Airman Owens at the court-martial. At this point, Your Honor, it wouldn't matter. Because at that point, motions practice was over, the military judge has made his rulings, and all of the DNA and forensic evidence was coming in. So regardless of the victim's memory suddenly getting better several months later, that wouldn't have mattered. Because all of the evidence, the derivative evidence pursuant to his statement, were already coming in at that point. Appellee also talks about the probable cause and how overwhelming it was. He talked about the cell phone, Airman Owens' cell phone. He's seen using his cell phone on the video. However, if you look at the results of the cell phone search, the rip of that phone, there's no link to the victim from that phone. He was texting it or trying to call an airman he had a crush on, an airman named Matt Neftak. She just so happened to live in that dorm building. But there were several floors to that dorm building. The victim and the appellant never knew each other, and the victim throughout the case and investigation stated that much. Now regarding the injuries, while unfortunate, the expert did testify that there was, and I see I'm out of time, Chief Judge, may I finish my,
please finish your
comment? The testimony of page 975 of the record shows that there actually wasn't that much force used. The victim was released from the hospital in approximately at 3 hours' time, and part of that time she was at the hospital was based on the Carabinieri forcing her to get a forensic examination safe against her will. Pending further questions, I have nothing further, Chief Judge.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel, thank you all for your arguments, and we want to thank E.C. Hastings for hosting us here today. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed. Please remain seated.